Jones v. Thurman.
May it please the Court, my name is Karen Manley and I represent the appellant, Mr. Yusuf Latif Williams. This is an appeal from the denial of Mr. Williams' petition for writ of habeas corpus. Due process right to an impartial jury is the hallmark of our judicial system. A jury is to remain free from external influences and should only consider evidence presented and subject to open court and subject to the scrutiny of an opponent. Mr. Williams' due process rights, however, were violated as he did not receive the benefit of an impartial jury. Rather, during the course of his trial, a court officer who had been charged with caring for jury during his 3 days provided substantive testimony on behalf of the prosecution. This is a flagrant violation of Mr. Williams' right to a fair trial.
But isn't this a fair step removed from what the Supreme Court was looking at in Turner? Because there you had the court personnel actively involved in the investigation of the underlying offense. And here, Mr. Hawk sees only this unpleasant interaction between Williams and the witness, where Williams is shouting and threatening and so on. But it's really not, I mean, there's just not a word spoken about the underlying murder. Since we're on habeas corpus at this point, don't we need a more direct holding from the Supreme Court before you can prevail?
A more direct holding from the Supreme Court?
To the effect that even this kind of, than Turner. I mean, the facts here are, I would submit to you, are different from those in Turner, since we don't have, Mr. Hawk did not investigate the underlying crime. He is not somebody that the jury was sitting there chatting with and eating with and otherwise learning outside the courtroom, or potentially learning outside the courtroom about the crime.
I don't agree. I think this is very close to Turner and Gonzalez. And in fact, as this court held in Agnew, where they said it was materially indistinguishable from Turner and Gonzalez, whereas in Agnew, the bailiff was only there for the first day of a 2-day trial. Here, the bailiff was in the court's and the jury's care, or caring for them, for 3 full days. The jury was unsequestered, but they were also unsequestered in Gonzalez, where it was just 1 day, and there 7 Supreme Court justices summarily reversed.
But what are they going to find out from Mr. Hawk? That Mr. Williams threatened the witness?
Well, in Turner, we're told about the type of testimony that's problematic. It's more than merely formal or uncontroverted testimony. It's substantive testimony. Testimony where the jury is asked to evaluate the credibility of the bailiff. That's what happened here. The testimony was that a man who was being charged with murder threatened to murder one of the prosecution's witnesses. This could have shown a propensity to commit the crime. In fact, during closing argument, and this is similar to what happened in Agnew, the state's attorney made a reference to the conversation with the bailiff, or that the bailiff allegedly heard, where he said, and what does he do? He basically painted Mr. Williams as a murderer. He said, and what does he do? How does he solve the problems? What did he threaten to do to Mr. Tate? Exactly what he did to Mr. Cooper. So they used this to line it up and say, this is how he does things. Showed a propensity. Additionally, as in Agnew, but unlike in Turner or Gonzalez, Mr. Williams took the stand on his own behalf, and he had an alibi, said he wasn't there. He had Ms. Deborah Towns speak on his behalf. So the jury was asked to evaluate Mr. Williams' credibility. What happens to that credibility? Well, it's certainly impeached when a bailiff in court uniform gets on the stand and directly contradicts some other testimony offered by Mr. Williams. I think that could have only influenced the jury and made them less likely to believe Mr. Williams' own testimony on his behalf.
So you think all of this would have been fine if they had just called Tate back and had him recount this exchange?
I think that's certainly an option that the government could have pursued, and not risk putting a bailiff and prejudicing the process. They could have called the direct party to the alleged conversation. Instead, they called a bailiff.
Well, he's the other party to the conversation. But if you could have gotten Tate testifying to all of this, why isn't all of this harmless error?
Well, here we're talking about a court officer testifying. And as the Supreme Court has recognized, it's important to keep the role of the prosecution, the defense, and the court separate. Those roles become blurred when a court officer takes the stand on behalf of the prosecution. And additionally, we should wonder how blurred those roles are when Williams, testified on his own behalf, and then on cross-examination, the state asked him, did you threaten Mr. Tate last night? They had no basis for that. Someone must have shared that information with him, presumably the bailiff. Again.
So that's the first time it comes into the
exactly.
record.
So you're comparing this to Turner versus Louisiana?
Yes, as well as Gonzalez.
The jury was sequestered in that case.
In Turner they were, and in Gonzalez they were not. Sorry if I misspoke.
And this jury was sequestered?
This jury was not sequestered.
Was not sequestered, yeah.
But there's certainly a difference in the relationship between a bailiff and a sequestered jury and those that are not, because it's just casual, incidental in and out of the courtroom and so forth.
I don't believe so, because in Turner, the court recognized that it's the, Parker versus Gladden. The Supreme Court recognized it's the official character of the bailiff, who's an officer of the court, as well as the state, that it beyond question carries great weight with the jury. And the type of in and out of the court interaction that I think wouldn't be problematic is something like, you know, passing a bailiff, not one assigned to that trial, in the hallway or in an elevator. That's the type of passing interaction. But when they're charged with caring for the jury in and out of the courtroom throughout the trial, through several days, that becomes problematic. Now, additionally, you might ask, well, what about the fact that we don't know what happened? As you said, oh, they were just going in and out of the courtroom. You know, we don't know what happened out of the court's eyes. And that in itself lies part of the problem here. It's the potentialities of what could have happened, as the court said in Turner, that would have made the courtroom proceedings a mere formality. And in Agnew, this court recognized that a lack of detail in the record doesn't necessarily mean that everything was fine. In fact, it leaves open the possibility that the interaction between the bailiff and the jurors could have been prejudicial. And that's what the court tries to prevent and should do their best to preserve the courtroom as a environment where the defense, the prosecution, and the state remain separate. You don't have.
So, I mean, in any event, a purportedly unbiased witness would not be allowed to testify.
I'm sorry, the.
Would not be allowed to testify, in your view? The bailiff.
No, not as to a substantive matter that's not uncontroverted. It's not just merely formal. It was controverted. Mr. Williams said he said one thing. The bailiff said he said another. So where it's a substantive matter, no, the bailiff should not be testifying. And in fact, in Agnew, the state recognized that they might need to call the bailiff, and they said, let's get a new bailiff in place. And even after the bailiff was replaced, the court in Agnew still said this was too prejudicial. That bailiff had only been around for 2 hours.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I'll stop if there's no further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd, representing the respondent, Michael Thurmer, in this habeas appeal from a district court's denial of Mr. Williams' petition for habeas relief. So, since we are here on habeas, as noted, the AEDPA applies. So we look at the state court decision, which denied Mr. Williams relief on this claim that Deputy Hack's testimony violated his right to due process. The state court decision, it's clear that the state court was aware of Turner, and that its decision denying Mr. Williams relief, I believe the decision reasonably concluded that what occurred in Mr. Williams' trial does not run afoul of Turner. I think this is so for several reasons. One, the record is wholly undeveloped as to, or perhaps it is developed and it's just so minimal, the relationship between Hack and the jury. The extent of it is outlined at his testimony on Appellant's Appendix, page 98. All he says is that he's assigned to security within the courtroom and other duties as assigned, which is totally different than the circumstances in either Turner or Gonzalez.
Did he mention anything about the jury at all?
No. No.
I wonder what, is it the position of the state that we're to disregard Gonzalez altogether? And if not, then what are we to make of Gonzalez?
I think Gonzalez is instructive. I'm not sure that it rises to the level of clearly established. I don't think that it matters in this case, even if this court were to find that it's clearly established law. Because
I guess what I'm getting at is, here we have a Supreme Court decision. I mean, at a minimum, it's a bottom line from the Supreme Court about a particular case. And I'm uncomfortable, given AEDPA, to think that we simply pay no attention whatsoever to cases from the Supreme Court like Gonzalez. That's not what the court's told us to do, actually. There's Marks. There are other cases that tell us how we're supposed to try to glean what is the fundamental rule that comes out of a case. Now, you don't get as much information out of a case like Gonzalez, where you've got a memorandum decision, where you've got some concurring opinions. But to say that it's nothing, is it seems to me not right either. So there must be at least something that we're to take from Gonzalez, and I wonder what that would be in your view.
I would use it just as something that reaffirms Turner. I don't know that you can take that it goes further into, you know, the unsequestered versus sequestered or that kind of thing, but I think that it is similar enough to Turner that I don't think it really makes any new law. I think
it reaffirms Turner on the basis of its own set of facts, right? So,
true.
You know, sequestered versus non-sequestered might enter into the picture at that point. If they think Turner, if the Supreme Court thinks Turner applies to the non-sequestered jury as well as the sequestered, then it does, right?
Yes, but I think that Justice Stewart also goes to great lengths to describe the intimate relationship that the jury had in Gonzalez, and that those facts are well established. They had lunch together and they hung out or whatever those kind of things were. So I think that maybe the sequestered, non-sequestered line doesn't exist after Gonzalez, but I think that there still has to be a record that there's an intimate relationship with the jury and a bailiff, unlike in this case where it's just, I'm the bailiff and that's all we really have. I think another important difference, as the court noted, is the substantive nature of the testimony. It just wasn't, did you kill Mr. Cooper? And I investigated this crime.
In Gonzalez, too, it's not uncommon or in some jurisdictions for the bailiff to, as you say, have lunch with the jurors to escort them to and from the court, even if they're not sequestered.
Right. And I understand the court's concerns with that, and I think that's very valid. But that's just, we just don't have that here. We, at least on ADPA review, we don't know that we have anything close to that here.
That's why I asked. He never mentioned jury at all.
Right.
So somebody should have taken his deposition afterwards and said, please describe in more detail your interactions with the jury?
I think that would have been an appropriate step to take, yeah. Get something in the record more than is there. There's just so little. And then I think it's also worth noting, as the district court did, that this was sort of an invited error. I mean, even if the state asked, did you threaten Mr. Tate last night, Mr. Williams denies that and then goes on to tell this story that he heard Mr. Tate expressing that he had been forced to inculpate him or whatever, and he specifically says, ask the bailiff. And just as a practical matter, at that point, although the state could have called Mr. Tate to refute it, the defendant himself said, ask the bailiff. So I think that the jury would have been left wondering why the state wouldn't have produced the bailiff. If there are no further questions, I just ask that you affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
What are we to do with this just ask the bailiff comment from Mr. Williams?
I don't think we're supposed to take it as assuming that Mr. Williams opened the door to
this. Why not? I mean, what else would be?
I think he was pushed through the door. I think the government opened the door for him when on cross-examination they said, hey, did you threaten Tate? He said, no, I didn't. Ask the bailiff. That door was opened for him, and he certainly did not waive a constitutional right to an impartial jury by a passing comment. The government didn't have to take that invitation, and we only waive such rights knowingly and consciously, and that certainly was not an effort to do so.
What do we know about this bailiff's relationship to this jury?
Well, we know enough is what we know, actually. We know that for 3 days he was in charge of them, and the record isn't wholly undeveloped.
We know that.
I'm sorry, his own testimony, the bailiff's testimony, he said throughout the trial, he was in charge of the jury. Throughout the entire trial. The only evidence we have where he was not involved is in the state's no merit brief below. I believe it's page 22 of the no merit brief. They say he wasn't there for deliberations. The bailiff was there for the entire trial. He was there after he testified. He was there during closing. He continued to have an impact on this jury. As the state said, the Supreme Court said in Turner, it would be blinking reality not to acknowledge the extreme prejudice inherent in a relationship between a bailiff and a jury. Now, you ask, what about Gonzalez? Isn't this the bottom line? It is. Gonzalez tells us a lot about Turner. 7 Supreme Court justices summarily reversed when a bailiff had one day with an unsequestered jury. Mr. Williams' bailiff had 3 days. 3 days to interact with that jury, to establish himself as a credible witness, a representative of the state and of the court. So it gives us some information about the scope and the boundaries of Turner, definitely. We ask that the court grant Mr. Williams writ for habeas corpus. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Manelli. You took this case by appointment, did you?
Yes, I did.
Again, as your colleague, I thank you for your vigorous representation of your client in this matter.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the process.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.